broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
She was tall and pliantly slender, without angularity anywhere. Her body was erect and high-breasted, her legs long, her hands and feet narrow. She wore two shades of blue that had been selected because of her eyes. The hair curling from under her blue hat was darkly red. Her full lips were brightly red. White teeth glistened in the crescent her timid mouth made. Spade rose, bowing and indicating with a thick-fingered hand the oaken armchair beside his desk. He was quite 6 feet tall. The steep, rounded slope of his shoulders made his body seem almost comical, no broader than it was thick. He kept his freshly pressed gray coat from fitting him very well. Miss Wonderly murmured, "Thank you," softly before, and sat down on the edge of the chair's wooden seat. Spade sank into his swivel chair, made a quarter turn to face her, smiled politely. He smiled without separating his lips. Dashiell Hammett in The Maltese Falcon. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe, Nick and Nora Charles, and even Lou Archer might be familiar names to those of you who have a little age on you. If you didn't read the books of Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross MacDonald, you perhaps listened to the radio programs based on their novels, or saw the films featuring Humphrey Bogart, Mary Astor, Lauren Bacall, Myrna Loy, Dick Powell, and other famous stars. Their most memorable books are perhaps Hammett's The Maltese Falcon, Chandler's The Big Sleep, and perhaps MacDonald's The Underground Man. The work of these authors is called hard-boiled fiction. We're going to talk about them today and the hard-boiled fiction they produced. My guest is Karen Houston Carides, author of the recently published Hard-Boiled Anxiety. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, Karen.
Thank you. I think it's going to be fun.
Looking forward to it, Karen. We know, Karen, that you are the acquisitions librarian at the Talbot County Free Library in Easton, Maryland. But tell us a little more about yourself and how a mild-mannered librarian came to write a book on hard-boiled fiction.
Well, I was a librarian for 29 years, and I am not a person of faith, but I have religion about public libraries. However, there's a collegial rigor to academic lectures and discussion and reading and writing, and I didn't want that to be over for me. I wanted to do that again, have that again. Also, I wanted to see if I could make myself do the work of a PhD. And I found out I could make myself do the work, and I was happy to know that. So here's something for everyone in Maryland who's listening. If you're 60 years old and a resident of the state of Maryland and get admitted into a degree program in a public university or college in Maryland, you go tuition free. So it's a good deal. So when I was 60, I stopped being a librarian for 5 years, and I went back and got a PhD in English. So that's how it started.
A PhD in English at 60. You're to be commended, Karen. But let me ask you, Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and Ross McDonald and Hard Boiled Fiction, how did you come to choose that as an area of study?
Well, when I was starting my year of getting ready to take my orals, I asked a guy in my class, you mean I could walk in there and they could ask me about Canterbury Tales and the next question could be about John Updike? And he said, no, it's not that bad. You get to pick a century and a country. So I was already interested in literary biography. So I picked 20th century American novelists and I read a work from each of 50 writers and then an autobiography, a biography, a memoir, literary criticism about each of them. So that's partly how I got to Hammett. That's how I got to Hammett. People always say to me, oh, you must read lots of mysteries. And I really don't. I was interested in hard-boiled fiction because it's an American invention. It's like jazz or public libraries. These are American inventions, and they pretty much have to be. No other country could have cooked these up. So I was interested in that way about it.
Well, Karen, what is hard-boiled fiction then? What is this genre that we created? I think back in the 20s it began.
Yes.
What is hard-boiled fiction?
Well, my working definition as I went through this was that it's an existential man in a nihilistic world. But you're right. The 20s is sort of when it came. Dashiell Hammett pretty much invented it. And it didn't come from Wilkie Collins and Conan Doyle. It really came from all those dime westerns that were published as United States spread west and west and west, in which the new sheriff in town gets the girl and cleans up the town and is the hero. And then you get to California and you run out of frontier. The biggest internal migration in the United States history is the one to California, and that ended with about the 20s. So that kind of wrapped up guys riding into town and cleaning up the town. So now you get urban westerns, and that was the idea, that the hard-boiled detectives were going to be urban westerns. But Dashiell Hammett did an interesting thing, because who he invented was not a hero. This was a guy who never got the girl, never had any money, lived in a cheap room. He didn't, and even the battles he fought, he didn't clean up the town. It was still, a rank, corrupt world. It's just he was one little guy going along trying to change things because he'd been hired to do it. And I was interested in that idea and why they didn't make them cops, make the heroes cops rather than private detectives, is because you had prohibition. And so the cops were bent. They weren't heroes. They were not being true to themselves, true to a code. But a private detective could do it.
Well, he was free, kind of,
yes.
to act on his own. Hard-boiled fiction, though, what you hit on it a little bit. What are the characteristics in general? Give us a little background here, because we're going to delve into some of these works, and particularly into the authors that produce these works. Give us a little background. What are the general characteristics of hard-boiled fiction?
I think pretty much what I said, that it's an existential man who kind of tries to live by his own code, and he's aware that the world isn't going to get a whole lot better, but he's looking at his own behavior and his own way of interacting. And as long as he's true to what he thinks is right, then even though this does not bring success, even though the world is just as bad as it was before, there's been a kind of triumph because he did what he wanted to do. He comported himself in that way.
A cynic?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Very much of a cynic.
Yeah, they're kind of wisecracking wise guys, you know, and that's very much a cynic.
One of the important things, as I read your book, one of the important things I found is that these books kind of picked up. But one of the characteristics is they've picked up the language of the street.
Yes.
Am I accurate here?
Yes, very much so. And by far the best writer in terms of dialogue and description is Raymond Chandler. And, of course, the irony to that is he was educated. He's a product of an English public school. He was an Englishman. But, boy, he got the lingo and he just wrote the pants off the other two, is what he did. Yeah.
And again, in terms of a general look, you say they were urban.
Yes.
These are urban writers.
Right.
And the hero, quote, is an urban guy. What was the attitude? You hit on a little bit. What was the attitude about the city, about the environment that they were working in?
Right. And there again, I meant to say before, it's no simple coincidence or something that all three of these were California guys. That's the end of the frontier. And all this hard-boiled stuff came out of hard-boiled writers in California and then movie makers, et cetera, in California. And the attitude towards the city at that time, because, of course, these cities had just grown exponentially so fast that there was a lot of crime and corruption. And, you know, these were not well-run, streamlined places to live. This was tough times. This was people feeling their way to living cheek by jowl when America hadn't really done that so much before, you know?
Well, what is the theme of your book, Hard-Boiled Fiction? What are you trying to say in this book?
Well, a couple of things. What I used as a starting point was the fact that Ross McDonald had a terrible childhood. And once both his parents had died, he had this 20 years of a willed performance, and it all looked so good. He shaped up remarkably in his personal life. He married the mayor's daughter, who'd been the president of his high school class. He got a PhD in English from the University of Michigan. I had a daughter, was in the U.S. Navy as a lieutenant during World War II, and then started writing these hard-boiled writers with Lou Archer as the detective. Then there was a great tragedy in his life with his daughter. He underwent analysis at that time because he was falling apart. And this was 1956 in California, and Freud was the zeitgeist. His daughter killed a boy, and that was in February of 1956.
Tell us that story. What? How did she kill this young man?
She was 16, living in Santa Barbara, a chronically sad person since she'd been a difficult child.
Not at that time.
Later, perhaps, and certainly her son. Anyway, she sat in a car and just drank through nearly 2 quarts of wine, started driving, ran down 3 boys from a middle school. They were walking home from their middle school's basketball game, killed one of them, maimed another, didn't stop. 10 minutes later, ran into the back of a parked car with its parking lights on and a couple inside, and threw it and them 60 feet. her car rolled over and she was detained and she lied. It took her 48 hours to admit to both accidents. A month later, she slit her wrists and was hospitalized. And in June of that year, she was found guilty of two felonies and sent to Camarillo Psychiatric Prison Hospital in California. And her father, Ross McDonald, was undone. And suddenly, as he said, his childhood vultures came back to roost. And he, who had been a very reticent man, wrote for her court-mandated psychiatrist a thing called Notes of a Son and Father, which was never published. It's in his papers at the University of California at Irvine Archives, talking about his childhood, etc. He found the process of writing it helpful to him. And he decided at long last maybe he should get some psychiatric help. So he underwent psychoanalysis in 1956, and Freud was in the zeitgeist.
This was Freudian analysis?
This was full bore, 5 days a week for years, Freudian analysis. And what I started to say is that Freud was on the cover of Time magazine on April 23rd, and that was between the February of the killing of the child and the June of being sentenced. So he was very much in the zeitgeist. And after McDonald did this, he thought, you know, you could write about Freudian archetypes and classical myths like Oedipus in the guise of hard-boiled fiction, which seems like a very unlikely thing to do. But... And the other thing is, he said doing that, and you can see the Lou Archer novels, he'd written six of them, and they changed on a dime for the last 12.
So this was kind of mid-career.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah. And as he says, he wrote himself well.
What was the year?
1956.
56.
Yeah.
He
not only said it was helpful to him to write these novels, he thought it was helpful to the reader, because his belief was that we all of us have sufferings in common and guilts in common, and that once you recognize that everybody has them, then they're not so determinative in your life. Then they go, once they're not depressed but expressed, you can go on to make the best of the rest of your life. And that's what he did, and he thought readers could do it, and he thought readers were integral. You had to have a reader. He wasn't writing a diary. He was writing for people, for other people. And I thought all of that was fantastic. It was fascinating. And public libraries privileged the patron. They privileged the patron over the book, you know, and it's the same sort of thing. He privileged the reader. He was writing it for the reader and writing it for himself.
Was he writing to make money?
Sure. All three of them were. They were doing it to write letters, to make money. They certainly weren't going to the bullfights with Hemingway, you know. These were working class. Dashiell Hammett had an eighth grade education. So,
well, what is your argument in the book, though? You've laid out a kind of a picture here of Ross McDonald
right.
going through psychoanalysis,
right.
a Freudian kind of analysis, which it is very interesting for
yeah.
us today. And I want to talk to you a little bit more about that later.
Okay.
That's Ross McDonald. What about the other two? How do they fit into the theme of your book and the argument that you want to make in your book?
What I wanted was, these are the widely acknowledged big three of hard-boiled writing. They really are a triumvirate. Hammett came first, and he invented the hard-boiled detective novel. Chandler elevated it. Matthew Broccoli, who was a literary scholar, talked about detective fiction going from the paperback racks to dissertation abstracts, and it does.
Let me ask you for a moment there. When you say he elevated, do you mean the fiction? Do you mean that he elevated the writing,
yes,
the quality of the writing,
yes,
the literary quality of it?
Yes, exactly. He elevated that. He elevated the writing into literature is what he did. But Hammett invented it. And then MacDonald began to see you can do a whole lot of adaptive purposes with it. But it's still the central thing. Anyway, one of the things that MacDonald and Sigmund Freud believed, along with other literary scholars such as Leon Edel, is that you can always find the man in the fiction, that all fiction is confessional, even if you don't want it to be, and even if you don't believe in Freudian archetypes, it's still there. I wanted a way to look at these three guys, and that was a way to compare them. And it was apt because MacDonald underwent analysis and wrote widely about his theory of this. A danger in doing it the way I did it is that the Freudianism can get too pat. It can kind of ostensibly explain everything. And I didn't explain these three men. They're inexplicable. We all of us are. But I could go back. I kind of played the game and went back and said, can I find these guys in their fiction? So in chapters called Sons and Fathers, Sons and Mothers, Sons and Father Figures, Sons and Mother Figures, Sons and Children, all these things, I played the game. If I looked at their lives, could I see that in their detectives? And it certainly is the case that any detective fiction, the closeness of the detective, particularly the narrating detective, and the writer, is very close. They write their whole career with the same protagonist in every book they write, which is a remarkable relationship.
And you're arguing then that they're writing themselves.
That's right.
And this is particularly true of Ross MacDonald because he said, that's
right.
What he's doing.
He was overtly doing it. Hammett and Chandler did. Hammett didn't want to do it, and Chandler was invested in convincing everybody that he was different than he really was.
And
but you can still find it. That's the idea.
Well, your argument is that they did it anyway. Hammett and Chandler did it anyway. Well, let me ask you to think about one of Ross MacDonald's novels. And tell us how you see him writing himself in that novel. Where are the comparisons that you see anyway between the two?
Oh, let's think. If you do the Galton case, which was part what happened to Chandler is what happened to MacDonald.
And you do this in your book,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I do this. I go through childhoods of each of them, marriages, etc. MacDonald was born in California to a man and wife, and his father was this wandering soul who sometimes wandered for years and did fascinating things. You know, he fought with the Indians and he started two newspapers.
An adventurer?
He was an adventurous soul. Now, he left his only child to his wife, and he knew that wife was not well enough to care for a child, and he left him anyway. And she certainly was utterly without emotional resources. And this was a rough go of a childhood. It was a bad childhood. Trying to think where I'm going.
So the Galton case, and she took him.
Anyway, when they broke off, she took him back to Canada, to cold Canada, and they lived in a bunch of different places, but they lived in a rooming house run by her mother. And this was all a very dour, dark sort of life. In the Galton case, you have, It starts with a grandmother trying to, a mother trying to find her son before she dies, and he had left. They had argued, and he had left, and it turns out. So Lou Archer goes looking for him and finds that he went from sunny California to Canada, then came back across the border like McDonald did when he went to the University of Michigan. So there are things along there.
And you lay out in your book these parallels.
Right. And the real thing that McDonald is doing is he's tracing generations. In a way, what he did is very interesting because he kept saying it's like detective fiction is like going to a shrink. Somebody goes at a point of crisis, and you go see a private detective because there's been a murder or somebody's disappeared and you want to find him. It's a crisis. So the detective says, all right, how did we ever get to this point? Who got murdered? Who might have done it? Why might that person have? And that's very much what a shrink does. What McDonald does is starts with somebody who comes because there's been a murder, and he said, how did this person get to this murder at this time? And he looks at the background of that person, and being Freudian, he goes back to the generation before that and the generation before that. And that's what he's doing in these novels. You can see him. He's going down the way, and as he says, it's like going, every time you read it, the reader's a little different than he was before. Every time, somebody said to him once, you write the same plot every time. And he said, no, it's like going to a shrink. You go and you tell the same story, sort of, over and over and over, and every time you do it, you learn a little more, and you learn a little differently, and it gets you well. What it gets you is well enough. He was learning to say well enough, make the best of things, not, euphoria on the hoof.
So this is kind of a coping mechanism that he has developed.
Oh, very much so. And it needs to be baldly stated that this analysis and this writing was of deadly importance to him. He was in bad shape.
What did it do for him?
It got him to a point of being able to make the best of the rest of his life, including a late-in-life long love affair with Southern writer Eudora Welty. It made him a happier man, a more positive man. He said, my novels made me a novelist, and that's what he meant.
And his wife at this time?
His wife, Margaret Millar, was also a writer of detective fiction. She wrote more domestic kind of detective fiction. But yes, they both were.
But he had a wife.
He had a wife.
And at the same time, he had an affair, a very significant affair with Eudora Welty.
He did. Now, it was late in life, and it's not altogether clear whether it was ever consummated, but it surely was an affair. It was an important. He was the love of her life, and it certainly was the most significant love of his. But his wife was an angry woman. But they reached eventually a point of sort of tenuous contentment, and he wrote to a friend of his who was going through a bad place in his marriage. I guess I don't believe in endings, so he's. And so they got to the far side of all this pain.
Well, let's go backwards.
Sure.
here to Chandler and to Hammett, because you say we know the whole Freudian approach,
right,
with Ross McDonald, and he tells us, and it's all open. And you argue in your book that even though Hammett and Chandler did not say this, that they are also basically autobiographical writers as well. You're saying that they wrote themselves. Yeah. Look at Chandler and tell us your argument for how he did that in his books.
Okay. An interesting thing about Raymond Chandler is that, and this is for the same novels, in the United States, he was considered a popular genre writer, heterosexual genre writer.
Let me remind our listeners that MacDonald was late 1940s, 1950s. Okay. We're talking about Chandler now. What period was he living and writing?
1930s.
So that's quite a difference.
Right. Chandler, MacDonald is almost the next generation. Yeah. Hammett was the 1920s and early 30s. Chandler, who actually was a little bit older than Hammett, but he came to writing later, was the 30s and 40s. So they kind of go along.
We were saying how did Chandler, these three guys, where are the women here anyway? But these three guys.
That's an interesting point.
How did Chandler write himself, and how do you surmise that he was writing himself into his novels as the detective Philip Marlowe?
Right. Chandler, as I started to say, was considered heterosexual, popular, dime store writer kind of in the United States. In England, he was lionized as a literary novelist, again, for the same novels, for The Big Sleep, for The Long Goodbye, and he was considered homosexual or bisexual. And he
there
is some. No, he never, he hadn't, whatever his sexual preference was, he certainly never owned up to any kind of homosexual feelings. By the time you get to MacDonald, the thinking is a little better, that sexuality is a continuum and stuff. Chandler never owned up to that. He did die of alcoholism, and alcoholism surely derailed his writing. And he never owned up to that, and he never beat it.
It just made me think he never owns up to these problems that he's got. But the other thing I think I remember about Chandler is that it was MacDonald who wrote under a pseudonym. That's right. Not Chandler.
Right.
MacDonald Chandler wrote it. Under his real
yeah.
name.
Yeah. And MacDonald did it. There's a wonderful quote in a new collection that came out of Margaret Millar's things where MacDonald says, "I long ago took a pseudonym and when you see how well my wife writes, you know why I took a pseudonym." Anyway, Chandler was very invested in people thinking he was heterosexual. He had an odd marriage to a woman who told him she was 7 years older than he was, and she was 18 years older than he was. And yet they incontrovertibly loved each other. And it seems as if in a long marriage, very reclusive marriage, that she was a knowing woman. She was a redhead who'd been divorced twice before at her instigation. And if he were homosexual, she would have found that out somewhere along the way, just as he clearly must have found out she was so much older. And they must have forgiven each other because they loved each other and they lived together all their lives. In any event, so Chandler was a raging homophobe, and he makes homosexuals die in sadistic, ghastly ways in his fiction. And he makes Philip Marlowe this knight errant, Galahad in Los Angeles, and what keeps him from being really fully literature is that he can't draw women very well. And the women Marlowe rescues are not damsels in distress. They're, as somebody said, witches and bitches and just not even always human. They're monstrous women. And that's who poor Philip Marlowe is going around rescuing. So it doesn't hang together. It doesn't work. And I think that's because he didn't really quite understand. He couldn't feel that. He couldn't write nuanced women. He went through his life saying his mother was a saint and this kind of thing. And he could write nuanced men, but not women. And that thwarted him in trying to be considered a truly literary author.
Well, in reading a few of their works, it seems to me, and please tell me if I'm wrong here, it seems to me that there is kind of a common approach to women in all three of their works. And that is to say, women do not come off very well.
No, they do
in
not.
In hard-boiled fiction. Yeah. Tell us a little bit. You're hitting on that now with Chandler's description of women. And my sense is that holds true for Hammett and MacDonald as well.
Yeah, Hammett has some... The women he loved in his novels are kind of working women. In his first novel, Red Harvest.
Now, what does working? Be careful there.
The first one was a working woman.
What does working women mean?
His first novel, The Red Harvest, has a prostitute in it named Diana Brand. And as she says, I'm strictly pay as you enter. And she invests her money. So I mean, she's quite a happy soul. She's making a lot of money and investing it,
She's not the evil witch.
Not like Chandler's. And Effie Perrine, Sam Spade's secretary, is another one. It's those sorts of working women is what I'm talking about. He was concerned about that marriage kind of tames men and the women run the show. And he was leery of domesticity. And that comes through in his. And a very interesting thing is that for all three writers, the vast majority of the murderers are women. Hammett only had one who wasn't, and that one was a male novelist. But otherwise, they're all women. So they were leery of women, I would say.
And so with this kind of picture,
right,
of women in the hardcore hard-boiled fiction, what is their relationship to sex? How does sex get played out? Remember, we're talking about the 20s and the 30s and the early 50s. And everything was, as you said earlier, nuanced and euphemism. Yeah. How did sex play out for these men?
For them personally?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for them and for their characters. And how was that? How did that carry over into their characters?
Well, there again, the vast majority of these guys aren't married. And Philip Marlowe never gets married. Sam Spade never gets married. The Gontenalop never gets married. Nick Charles in The Thin Man, which was the last of the novels, is married. But even that is a cautionary tale. The wife has the money, and they're living on her money in a hotel in New York. And he's not really much of a hard-boiled detective. The clues all come to him, and mostly what they do is drink and be witty, you know. And Hammett loved his wife, and they had two daughters. And his love for his daughters is the source of much of the best in his life in terms of how he lived. And he loved his wife. He was still writing to her in 1961 when he died, and he hadn't lived with her since 1928, something. But He was leery of domesticity, and he and his wife initially broke up because he had TB, and it was active, and his doctors thought he shouldn't live with children.
Yeah, the doctors suggested that he...
And then even after it went into remission, by that time, they kept it as an excuse because he really didn't want to live in a domestic situation. And he never did. He never did with Lillian Hellman, despite, again, a long love affair.
Well, wait a minute. What is this about Lillian Hellman now? All when of a sudden, was, the famous
the
Lillian
famous
Hellman.
Lillian Hellman. He met her. It's remarkable because he met his wife because she was a TB nurse in a veterans hospital in 1921. And at that point, he had an eighth grade education. He had untreatable tuberculosis. He expected to die within a year, and she thought he would. So he was not a catch, you know, but they loved each other and got married. By 1933, when he meets Lillian Hellman, he's the man of the hour, and he's, you know, spending all his money. So he changed she got a very different man than Josephine Hammett got. And then they had this long love affair, and they lived together fleetingly here and there, and they got angry and went elsewhere, and they were not monogamous, either one of them, but they loved each other, and that was a very long love affair that lasted until he died, and she helped him when he died. She was with him when he died.
Was this a scandal in the 1920s and the 1930s, these affairs of Chandler and Hammett?
I think they sort of got a pass because they were Hollywood people, and they were writers, and they were cosmopolitan, and... Yeah, I'm sure the churches on Sundays didn't like it that they were doing this, but I think they sort of got a pass because of that.
And the magazines?
As far as I know, it certainly didn't hurt their popularity or their sales, right. You know.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, in terms of Hammett, the novel I'm the most familiar with would be The Maltese Falcon, a wonderful movie with Humphrey Bogart and Myrna Loy, I think, and I remember seeing that as a young person. Yeah, your Freudian analysis, your Freudian approach. How does that fit Hammett's life and say the Maltese Falcon? Can you find the relationship there?
Hammett, very much as a kid, and he had a father who was a philanderer, said to favor beauticians as his philanderer. In any event, Hammett was searching for a way to be in the world, a way to operate in the world. And he saw an ad when he was 21 in the paper in Baltimore saying, for the Pinkerton Detective Agency, willing to go all over the country, orphans preferred, it said. And he joined the Pinkertons, and his parents hoped it would make a man of him, and it did. And it's because the Pinkertons had a code. Stay anonymous, stay rational, stay true. And you're always on the job. You're always on code, and that gave Hammett a code. And in his detective fiction, he's interested in MacDonald is interested in the plot because he's tracing families back. Hammett is interested in the detective and whether the detective can stay on code. And he wrote a lot of short stories first, and the detectives did. When he started writing novels, it's a willed performance. They couldn't keep it up. And the question in Red Harvest, in his first novel, is the detective going to get blood simple? In other words, lusting after killing. That's how the Coen brothers got the title for their movie, Blood Simple, is from Red Harvest. In The Maltese Falcon, the question is Sam Spade, who beds Bridget O'Shaughnessy, who comes to see him, you know, as a client, is he going to turn her in for killing his partner, whose name is Miles Archer, which is how Ross McDonald got his detective named Lou Archer. Anyway, is he gonna turn her in, even though he bedded her and for that matter bedded Miles Archer's wife, but he turned him in.
His secretary.
And in any event,
he was a busy man.
And Hammett said once, "I like women. I really like women." He said.
You have a staircase.
I do. Oh, yeah. In some of those early 1930s in Hollywood, he literally had women crossing on the stairs. In any event, the question was, he going to turn her in anyway? And he does. And he says, "You killed my partner. You can't, you know, that has to be avenged. Justice has to be done." So the question is always in his, are they staying on code? That's the big question. So he cares about the detective.
I mean, it's interesting to me that for me, and the limited reading I've done in the field, it seems to me that that Sam Spade is somewhat, how would I say it? He is more hard-boiled than Philip Marlowe or even than Archer. That Philip Marlowe wants to help people. Somebody's always lost or been taken, right, and he goes to find them and restore them. Philip Marlowe and Archer seems to me, in reading, again, the limited reading that I've done, that detective seems to be kind of a normal person, almost. Sam Spade is an incredibly, for me, an incredibly cynical, incredibly nihilistic. And I'm not sure. And just a angry, uncaring, bitter man. The code is there. There's no question. He's loyal to his client. He's economical. He's all those things. But at the same time, he seems to me in the Maltese Falcon to be darker, to be more cynical, not sinister, cynical. And the Bridget O'Shaughnessy part, I read Marlowe never beds the women that come on to him, at least in my limited reading. I'm not sure Archer does either. I don't know. No. Not read that. Spade, though, he's no qualms.
No.
I mean, he has no qualms about taking Bridget O'Shaughnessy to bed, even though he knows he is going to turn her in. Do you see this kind of relationship that I've outlined here?
Yeah, but they're all still hard-boiled detectives. But you're right. You're absolutely right. Sam Spade and the Continental Loft are certainly very cynical, as is Nick Charles. They're really all they're very much cynics and nihilistic. They have a nihilistic worldview. Chandler, who was sweaty and uneasy in the company of women, and just he couldn't see them as more than two-dimensional characters, drew a knight. That's a K-N-I-G-H-T knight in Philip Marlowe, who rescues women. He's really like a romantic hero in the, in the romantic literary tradition of knights, of knight errants. So they're very different people. Now, Chandler's Los Angeles is a nihilistic world. There's no question about that. But you're right. They're very different men. As for Lew Archer, and there again, in the 12 novels he writes about him after 1956, he sort of disappears. He gets less and less and less. And as he says, solve is not really what I'm doing. I'm trying to understand. He gets almost as anonymous as a good analyst, where he really puts in very few words. He just watches and goes back and listens to people and figures out what happened. So he almost loses a personality. And MacDonald said he certainly is not the character I was most interested in, you know.
Well, Hammett was an alcoholic as yes. well. And I think we would almost say, even from this brief discussion, that their lives were a mess.
Yeah.
And yet they took and made something positive right. out of that in terms right. of their writing. And we've got to recognize that.
Sure.
Sam Spade and Hammett, Dashiell Hammett, made a significant change, particularly the author Hammett. Tell us about how his life, what happened that his life changed. He was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And then there something happened.
Yeah.
That even though Dashiell Hammett, from St. Mary's County, I
That's
believe.
Right.
Dashiell Hammett has the most cynical
yeah.
of all of the detectives.
Yeah.
And yet it's Dashiell Hammett that, for me anyway, as the brief look I've had, changes, turns his life around.
He does, and MacDonald does, and
okay.
Chandler never does. He never owns up to this. Hammett, if you win the silent auction and can have dinner with one of these three guys, go with Hammett.
No, I would. I would go with Hammett.
He's funny, and he's very interesting.
But what happened? Tell us what happened.
He got this diagnosis of he enlisted in World War I. He got this diagnosis of tuberculosis, untreatable tuberculosis. He thought he was going to die. His girlfriend was pregnant. They got married. They had a second daughter. And then lo and behold, the TB went into remission when he was about 29 years old. By then, as his friend Nunnally Johnson said, he lived his whole life as though he didn't expect to be alive past Thursday. And he was like that. He wrote his novels. He wrote The Thin Man in 1934. He lived until 61. But part of what happened to him was he became a member of the American Communist Party, and he was an active member. He wasn't just somebody who put his name on the masthead. And through his belief in Marxist philosophy, he came to believe the world could get better, could be made better, and he couldn't write a hard-boiled detective in a nihilistic world if the world didn't have to be nihilistic, if there was a way out.
What is a nihilistic world?
Nothing's going to get better. The corruption is always there.
There's no meaning.
There's no meaning. The only meaning is in how you conduct your life.
That's the existential man part.
Yes,
very good.
Yes. Anyway, very good. He came to believe it didn't have to be nihilist, that it could get better. And so then he couldn't write it.
Came
like
to believe that.
That
he could make it better.
Yeah, he came to believe man could make it better. And he couldn't, so he stopped writing. And he did this. And incidentally, if you see what the American Communist Party espoused in the 30s, it was voting rights for blacks, unions, the rights of federal and state employees to have political views. You know, nothing too exciting in our day, sort of. And he did that. He lost aggregate years to alcoholism. And then in a very Hammett-like way, a doctor in 1948 told him, if you keep drinking, you'll kill yourself. And he said, I'll stop. And he did. And he never talked about it. He just stopped. He enlisted in World War II. He was 48 years old.
He was in two wars.
He was in two wars. He enlisted both times. He was his own kind of patriot. He really believed in this country. He's buried in Arlington Cemetery. So he did turn his life around. He mentored Lillian Hellman. He taught writing. He taught at the New School for Social Research in New York City. So he did other things, but he did not write any more hard-boiled fiction.
Let me ask you, we're almost out of time here. Let me ask you one last question. The work of these three men captured the imagination of the American public unbelievably, and still does capture the American public. Why? What is it about these authors, this and the simple stories with these hard boiled men?
Yeah.
What and their terrible view of women. What is it about these novels that captures the American imagination?
I think a part of it is it didn't hurt that some very good movies were made of these guys. And the Maltese Falcon, the one that's so famous, was the third try. The earlier one was a terrible flop. This one was John Huston's first directorial. It was his debut. And he said, I shot the book. You know? So I think that helped. They were writing good books. They were writing interesting people. I think the literature is there. I think these were memorable characters, memorable detectives, particularly for Hammett and Chandler.
I'm not wondering that perhaps it was hard times. And it's certainly the 20s and the 30s, and not so much the early 50s, but the 20s, 30s, and the 40s was hard. Was hard times.
And it says something about the American public that in 1934 in the Depression, they thought The Thin Man was a madcap comedy. That's how they saw it. Uh-huh. And these people were rich, and they had money, and they lived in a hotel in New York, you know. And I think that caught at people.
But didn't they see to some degree this literature as their literature, the common man? I mean, Ulysses was written at the same time.
Yeah.
T.S. Eliot was writing at the same time. They're not going to read T.S. Eliot.
No.
They're not going to read Ulysses. But they're going to read somebody who talks the way they do.
Exactly.
And who has the same kind of problems.
That's right. That's right.
That they do.
Yes. And one of MacDonald's many theories, one of his theories was you have to have a popular fiction in a culture before you can grow a literary fiction. And these were American novels. And America wasn't taking a backseat to Great Britain or any other, you know, part of the world. These were their novels and written in America by working class guys.
You started off by saying they wrote themselves into the fiction. And part of the argument was, can we always find the author in the fiction?
Right.
Can we always... your opinion. Can we find the author?
I think when you finish my book, you've got three questions. The first question is, were MacDonald and Freud right? Can you find the man in the fiction? The second question is, if you can, does it buy you anything? Do you get more out of reading the fiction if you know about the man? And the third question, and this is the queasy question for me, is it fair game to do this? It's certainly fair game with MacDonald because he overtly did it and wrote about doing it. But is it fair game with Hammett, who was a reticent man and certainly never meant to write himself into it? And above all, is it fair to Chandler, who wasn't honest with himself, much less to anyone else, and was trying desperately to invent a persona and have it look like that's his persona, too. So that's the third queasy question.
For Hammett and Chandler.
Right.
How do you answer these three questions?
I eventually answered them yes. In the first place, they wrote these books for publication. In the second place, I certainly want to believe in MacDonald's theory that it takes three things to make a book. It takes a writer, it takes the actual words of the book, and it takes a reader. And you got to have that reader, a perceptive reader, a responder to the fiction. It's not really a book until somebody reads it, you know. And if you're a librarian who's in the business of getting people, putting books in people's hands, you care about that reader. That reader is important.
This really runs to the question of why we write fiction. I mean, who else are you going to write into your fiction?
Right.
If it's not the person at least you think you know.
Right.
You know the best. Karen, your book is Hard-Boiled Anxiety. Where can we get your book?
You can get it from Amazon. You can get it from Barnes & Noble. Secant Publishing bought the rights to it, and you can get it from them in Salisbury. It's S-E-C-A-N-T. And I think just to close, Joan Didion said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And I think that's why we write fiction.
Karen Houston Carides, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. This is Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.